Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight, we hope, is Hall of Fame poker player Barry Greenstein. Barry was supposed to have called in. As of now, we're hoping he calls in. You may hear Bob and Richard scramble tonight. We received an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com concerning the Silver Fox Blackjack counting system. Richard, this is in your wheelhouse. Is that a good count?
Well, it's a fine count. Actually, I thought that the email was rather interesting because the... Pardon me, the listener said that he was new to blackjack and had started learning, and he looked on Craigslist and found someone offering blackjack lessons for $30 or $35 an hour. And he had been learning the high-low, but he started taking some lessons from this particular guy who said he was a professional blackjack player, and this guy convinced him to switch to the Silver Fox count. And so I guess he felt like he was getting value from the lessons, that he was learning something. But he just wanted a second source. You know, he said if you have to have surgery, you get a second opinion. He wanted a second opinion that this was really a good count. And he couldn't find any books about it. Now, there is one book written by Ralph Stricker, but it's long out of print. So there really, you know, aren't any books that I'm aware of other than Ralph's. I would say for beginning blackjack players, I would be leery of getting blackjack lessons from Craigslist. But, you know, if you think you're getting value from this guy, then great. But I would also recommend two websites. One is called blackjacktheforum.com, and the other is bj21.com, where you can get a lot of your questions answered. And also one other site, QFIT.com, where QFIT offers a number of different software programs, and one of them is a count analyzer. So you can plug the Silver Fox in and compare it to the high-low or the KO or any other count that you want, and it'll tell you how it compares. The important thing is... Which count you use really doesn't matter as long as you can play it perfectly, you know? And to my mind, the simpler the better. You want to be able to play it for long hours without making any mistakes. So if right now you're comfortable with the Silver Fox, then stick with it.
Now, the simplest strong count is probably KO.
KO or the Red 7 are both unbalanced counts. And really the only thing that makes them simpler is that they don't adjust for a true count. But, you know, I just don't think it's that difficult to, you know, divide by 3 or 2 or 4 or whatever to get a true count.
But some people might have trouble dividing by 2.7.
Well, but they don't have to, you know, just divide by 3. And here's the thing about card counting. The money is in your bet spread and how deep the penetration is, how deep they deal the deck. And then the third thing would be the number of hands per hour that you can play, right? So when the bet spread is much more important if you're playing shoe games than whether you vary your playing decisions. So what I would say is... divide by whole decks, round up for your betting, and round down for your playing decisions, you know. and, you know, you'll be fine. Bet more money when the count is high. That's the key.
All right. So I got an email, also gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. This one's about video poker. This was a guy telling me that my software was wrong or my winner's guide was wrong. The game was 9-6 jacks or better, arguably the easiest game out there. And the hand in question was a suited queen-jack-10, three cards to a royal, an offsuit jack, and a five. The only reasonable choices are the holding the pair of jacks or holding the queen-jack-10. And the correct play actually depends on the game you're playing. And jacks are better. The jacks are correct by quite a bit. But in some forms of double bonus, it's better to go for the three-card royal. Or double-double bonus, for that matter. But he told me that my software must have been wrong because he put the hand in and it told him to hold the three-card royal, where my book said not to. I've gotten a lot of these emails, and what almost invariably happens is it's user error. Somebody he entered in a high value for the royal flush, or he entered in a high value for the straight flush, and then he compared the hands, and sure enough, the play changed. In this particular case, instead of it happened instead of a 4,000 royal, he had it plugged in a 5,000 royal because he was going to be playing this progressive, and then he just simply forgot that he had done this. And so people do this all the time. They change it, and then they come in, and they say there's a mistake. So before you send me this email, please check again. You haven't changed the pay schedules. I have gotten hundreds of those emails over the year. Does this happen on blackjack software, Richard?
It does, and usually it's the same kind of player error where the players put in the wrong rules or the wrong number of decks or something like that. You know, and so yeah, that those kind of things do happen. Bob, if you can riff for just a minute, I've got Barry and on the email here, and we're having trouble.
All right. Okay, good. So Rich is concentrating on contacting Barry. The one of the things we were going to talk about is the World Series of Poker main event. Now it's in the 4 months after they got down to nine players, and in first couple days of November, the November 9 will play over 2 days and take those nine players down to one. So one of the questions that we wanted to do is to ask Barry about is how do you handicap this? Now, on the online betting sites, now they're not in the United States, but the online betting sites generally have the handicapping very close to the initial chip stacks. So the guy in first place with the most chips, well, he's favored. Well, he's least not favored to win. In other words, nobody's a favorite to win, but the odds are best for him and down. So for the most part, there's only one player who isn't in order of this order. All right, so apparently we have Barry Greenstein on the air. Barry Greenstein is a very successful poker player. He's won 3 World Series of Poker bracelets, 2 from the World Poker Tour. He's a member of the Poker Hall of Fame. Barry Greenstein, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hey, nice to be out.
It is really nice for us, though. We were having heart palpitations here and trying to wonder how we were going to scramble for 45 minutes. So it's lovely to hear your voice.
Yeah. I just looked back at the email and I saw I was even money. One of the messages had the right number and one had the wrong number.
All right.
Anyway, we're here. Let's go. I'm ready to go.
All right. World Series of Poker. We're in the hiatus between after the November 9 is determined, but before it comes to November 1, do you have any thoughts about handicapping this, or who's going to win, or do you care?
Well, I thought Martin, you know, the European guy, was the strongest player from what I knew from, you know, past history, strongest tournament player. But he
was like eighth level. He's eighth in chips.
He's like eighth in chips now. So he's got some work to do. And, you know, normally you have to go with the people at the top. And, you know, I think what we've been seeing over the years is stronger and strong, you know, a lot of strong final tables, you know, where the players are all pretty confident. You know, we all know that, you know, you need a lot of luck to get this deep, but you also need a lot of skill. And I think, you know, there's no reason to pick, you know, anything really out of the ordinary besides, you know, how much the people have in chips as a barometer.
Now, you have what I gather is a pretty new website, BarryGreenstein.com.
Well, it used to be an old website, but there's a long story that we might get to that I saw you guys give me a heads up on some of the questions about how I lost lots of possessions when I went away for a while. And one of them was my website that people used to like. It was an old website where I had ratings of players and lots of really fun stuff and music and everything, but I lost my domain. But that's another story. So now, now it's up and running. PokerStars kind of runs it.
I see. Now, I saw a post where it was early in the WSOP where you were saying you were having a really bad WSOP, and I'm wondering how the second half of it went for you. How was the WSOP for you?
It was bad. I only had two deep runs, and one of them was in one of those no-limit tournaments where I thought I was going to go real deep. There were a little over 50 players left. I flopped a straight flush draw when I had a lot of chips, and I guess I always play those hands fast. I could have played it more fastly, but I got all my chips and for pretty much the chip lead at that point. So, you know, it's something that paid, I don't know, I never looked at the prize pool, but I assume $600,000-$800,000 for first. So that was my through ticket hand to the final table probably, and I bricked out. And then I had a pretty good run in the 10,000 stud. One of the things that was real annoying with the tournament, the first three $10,000 events, I went out within one table of the money.
Oh.
So, you know, which makes it really annoying. You know, when I got, you know, sometimes I even had decent chips, and I just never won a hand once I got to that point. And I, you know, even with the stud event, I said this would be annoying if it happens again. But I did at least finally win a couple hands at the penultimate table to the money, and I got in the money, but only 13th, and, you know, the big money is until you come in the first few spots. So I don't remember a World Series. I think there's one other since I've been playing a lot of tournaments, which is 2004, where I didn't make a final table. You know, there might be one other time. And I played more events this year, I think, than I've ever played. And the reason I played more is because I did so poorly. Normally I stay in tournaments, or, you know, I'll have some that I stay in 3 days, and the 50K I'll stay in 4 days. And so I miss out on a lot of events. And normally I play about 20 events. I'm afraid to count up how many events I played this time, because I basically was playing a new event every day because I kept getting knocked out.
Now, I also wanted to ask about, there was a pretty famous bet going on with Daniel Negreanu betting that either he or Phil Ivey would win a bracelet at even money. And I'm wondering.
No, I think it was 2-1.
I thought it was even money.
No, it was even money. Phil and I used to have that bet each year, actually. And we won some years and lost some year, you know, some other years. And, you know, pretty much, you know, I assume Daniel initiated it. And pretty much, if you're Daniel or me or you're anyone else, and you're going to initiate a bet where you and someone else are going to win a bracelet, the other person you pick is going to be Phil Ivey.
Right.
That's what it comes down to. And Phil himself is probably about a 2-1 dog to win a bracelet, you know, meaning if you look over his career at the World Series, you know, better than for him to be 2-1, he'd have to have won a bracelet a third of the years he played, but he's actually done better than that. So, you know, Phil looks like he's within 2-1, although that's maybe a little bit misleading because you have to take into account that the fields are getting bigger. And possibly the players are getting better. You know, the players are certainly better at PLO and No Limit Hold'em. I'm not sure if they're that much better at the mixed games, but probably they are, because if you think of the poker boom, a lot of our, you know, good young players came out of the poker boom, and, you know, now they're learning all the other games, you know, getting, you know, closer to expert level, and people play the mixed games online more than they did, you know, back a few years ago. Those mixed short field mixed games, you know, are variants that, you know, other than Hold'em and PLO used to be pretty sweet, you know, going back 5-6 years ago. Now, you know, obviously there are more people who can play the games.
Did you take either side of this, the Ivy Negreanu?
No, I would. I never, you know, Phil and I are pretty close, so I would never bet against him anyway. You know, even if I thought I had the best of it. You know, I've tried to, like I said, I've had money on me or Phil winning a bracelet several times in the past, so at even money. Normally it's hard for us to get takers, and, you know, obviously Daniel's tournament game, you know, he's younger than I am. He's, you know, had a pretty good World Series, obviously, compared to my pretty bad World Series. Daniel's done a lot better. He almost won a couple himself.
Well, he did come in second place in the $1 million buy-in, which kind of boosts his average pretty good.
I thought he had another close call, too, or something.
He did.
Maybe not.
He did. All right. Ace on the River, it's your book. What's that all about?
Well, that's about how to make money playing poker, and it also has stuff about the life of a professional poker player. And it's a lot, you know, a lot of psychology, and, you know, a lot of people think that if you learn how to play poker, then you're going to win a lot of money playing poker. And there are just a lot of pitfalls, and that's a small part of it. It's probably the smallest part is learning the games. But how to make money at poker, or even gambling in general. I noticed your show is the Gambler's Edge. This isn't a poker show, right? This is a gambling show.
Correct.
We cover all forms of advantage gambling, yeah.
We have had a number of poker players on here, though.
Right, so any kind of gambling, there are just lots of pitfalls. You know, I've played blackjack, made money at that, and you know, done lots of, you know, bet sports, you know, whatever it is. There are just traps in all these things. And a lot of people think, oh, I have an edge one way or the other, and I know something, and so I'm going to make money. But, you know, there are obviously traps of not getting paid, getting cheated. You know, there are all sorts of things that can happen when you're a gambler. And so my book has a lot of advice on how to steer clear of bad things happening to you. And so it's pretty much, you know, tells my growth as a gambler, and, you know how I learned to win money instead of, you know, losing money.
And it's still relevant today.
I think it'll always be relevant. You know, that and Socrates, those things will be relevant, you know, for thousands of years.
Always good to compare yourself to Socrates.
Right. Yes. So, yeah, the poor guy. Yeah. Put in jail for not believing in the gods of his time. He'd be rolling over his grave seeing all our religious wars going on now.
Right. So Bob and I are both authors, and, you know, we often laugh about people, you know, saying that other people are selling out, just making a lot of money by writing books, not realizing that there's probably one of the worst things you can do to make money is try to write a book. But it seemed like your book in particular, you ran into quite a buzzsaw. Do you want to tell that story about what happened with your publisher?
Yeah, it's a long story, and I guess it's probably on my personal blog. You know, I think it's on BarryGreenstein.com. I can't remember. Some of the things I write go on PokerStars blog, and some go on to my website. And I get confused because, you know, I write these things, give them to PokerStars, and let them put them up in different places. But anyway, yeah, I lost a lot of money, and I was at the highest earning point of my poker, where I was making a few million dollars a year, and I just at that time thought, oh, I've got enough money. And as a lot of people know, I didn't even want to write a book, but Doyle kept bugging me to write something for his book, Super System 2. And you know, I kept writing, and every time I come home from a poker session, I'd come up with another idea, something that I thought should be included. And it just got really big, and too big to put in his book. And so finally I just made it my own book. So but anyway, it was offered six figures advance because that was during the poker boom, and people did want to, there were publishers who wanted to get behind it and, you know, get into the poker book genre. But I turned it down because I figured if I'm going to write a book, I want it to be the best book, the best presentation, the best paper, the best color, and color printing. Was really good color printing just wasn't out there for any books, and I wanted mine to be state of the art. And anyway, like I said, the whole story's in the blog I wrote. But I ended up spending like $500,000 to put out 100,000 books. Plus, I paid people that I staffed to help produce the book, and it costs a lot of money. And then I didn't need the money at the time, and so when I did get the first few checks, I spent it on advertising at USA Today and other publications. I just spent the money, and then after a while, I thought I'd get some more royalty checks, and they stopped coming. And I'll just try to cut it out, but the money was being embezzled is what happened, and the story's in the blog, and so it was a nightmare. I did get some tax relief from it, which I didn't see coming, but it cost me a lot of money. I would guess writing that book probably cost me $2 million, when you take what I lost and what I lost in income, somewhere in that range. So I always think it's funny, people say, oh, yeah, here's another guy, just like you say, got in there just to spit a book out so he could make some money off the poker boom. Yeah, that's negative $2 million, that's what it was for me.
Well, then I'm a considerably more successful author to you. I'm down far less than $2 million for being an author.
I calculated my earnings, and I figure they were about a dollar an hour for my book. So
all right. Yeah. So there was a $7 app for playing Chinese poker or something where there was a problem and you kind of got caught up in that. Can tell us what happened.
Yeah,
there?
It's another long story that I'll try to cut short. But yeah, some funny things were happening. I thought, it's one of those things when you gamble. If funny things are happening and you're losing, normally you just quit. But you first look. I've had it happen before, probably 10 times, where I found there were things on the cards and cameras and all sorts of ways. People would mark cards or have signals, and I've caught probably over my life maybe 10 different cheating, situations where, I was able to exactly determine what happened. But, if you lose, you can't always say when you lose you got cheated, of course. And, there'll be times you don't know. I remember, I used to go to 2 different clubs, and one of them, the game seemed better, but I'd lose. And since I lost, I end up going to the one where the game wasn't as good. And I can't claim... I may have gotten cheated, I may not have, but I never found anything, so I never thought much of it. But it's one of the things you do as a gambler. Even if you think you have an edge, if you keep losing at something, you just have to give it up. So this is one of those things where really suspicious results. And then when I compared with other people, they were getting suspicious results too. So I had a nephew who he was good with computers, and he had never played around with these apps. But I just said, could you take a look at the thing? I mean, I almost feel like this guy knows what cards are coming. And he called me back a half hour later and said, yeah, it's trivial. The stuff's not encrypted. Anyone who knows anything about how this stuff gets sent can just intercept with what's called a proxy server and can see the cards. Their numbers from 0 to 51. He can see your whole hand, and he can see his hand, and he could set up any hand, and he could change it. And so people were playing for thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so just to prove it, I said, hey, why don't you invite Jason Mercier, who's playing for a lot of money, and send him a hand. And right off the bat, he sent Jason a royal flush, and then he sent out one, because he could change the cards. He said, yeah, this is a joke for anyone who knows about this stuff. And then once we found out all the connections, we found out that one of the guys involved actually was involved with security for apps and know easily how to do this. So it became pretty clear, at least the evidence seemed pretty clear, that I was getting cheated. But never 100%, because you don't have someone admitting it or even taking a lie detector test, but it really was solid evidence. One of the things I'm really annoyed about is, sometimes, I've had, you have some situations where you do something, like here, and you say, this doesn't look right, and people don't get the whole story, and then they think, oh, Barry's trying to get out of paying a debt or something like that. I had it with the Full Tilt scandal, where I didn't want to give the money to the Tapey Group, and I didn't want to give the money to Full Tilt. I want to make sure it went to the players, which eventually it did. But some people just see things and think, I guess maybe because they're dishonest themselves, they always assume everyone else is dishonest. But, I usually try to do the right thing. And so what I did with this thing is I said, well, it looks really bad to me, but I don't want to take the chance of not paying someone on the off chance, just it was really, really coincidental, all the things that happened. So what you normally do in gambling is you get an arbitrator. And I said to the guy, I don't want it to be one of my friends or someone who's in, you know, just in the middle, because you're drawing dead because the evidence is overwhelming. You pick a friend of yours who, you know, has a reputation of honesty to arbitrate. So I think that's about the fairest thing anyone could even do. I insisted to be a friend of his. And believe it or not, we've gone through three friends of his that when they hear the evidence say, that looks really bad, and I hate to rule against them, so I'd rather not do a ruling at all. So they've taken themselves out of the arbitration. Yet somehow there, I've had, like, even on Twitter, some guy thinking that, oh, I've tried to get out of paying a debt. I mean, I paid like $200,000 on the app, and this wasn't even a big debt. And the, and even, not only was it not a big debt, but the guy who I had this conflict with owes money to someone who owes me money, so I could even transfer most of the debt. So it's not even money. But I just didn't want the guy to get away if he's guilty, and I wanted to go to arbitration. So, I mean, I've been, you know, bent over backwards to be fair.
Yeah, it sounds like you've gone above and beyond.
Yeah, and it's funny how people will take things out of context, but they, oh, it's just another guy trying to get out of paying the debt. And I'm sure some people, once they found out that the app was compromised and eventually it got encrypted, it was really an easy thing to do. But the software was originally written by guys who wrote game software and didn't know there'd be gambling on the app. And so they never even, you know, it wasn't spec'd out for them to encrypt it. And my nephew just looked at the Apple documentation, and it was a, you know, really easy thing. They have their own encryption stuff. So the fix was like a half-hour fix.
Wow.
To make it so it was encrypted. But in the meantime, of course, people who lost, I mean, some people think they got cheated. There are lots of people who didn't get paid, and I'm sure a lot of them were honest. You know, a lot of them who won weren't cheating. But we have a group of people who had really suspicious results where they beat everyone. And, you know, it's like if the cards are marked and someone's winning and you're losing, you take the cards home and you find out they're marked, there's a chance the guy didn't use the marks, you know, the marked cards to beat you, but it's going to look pretty bad. You're going to have a hard time believing that it was just a coincidence.
Right, right. What about, you playing the big game over in Macau?
No, I really kind of screwed up, you know, it's one of probably a lesson in my book. When I first went to Macau, before any of these things got that big, I heard the rake was 5%. I had to go over. I was one of the first people because I went over PokerStars. And as far as I know, they opened the first poker room there for a tournament. Now, I'd gone over a couple times, but I said, oh, I'm not going to play in that game with the rake that big. And then one of the times I was just so bored, I said, like the second year, I said, well, I'll just sit down and play in, you know, $5,000 buying game or something like that. And then I realized these guys, these Asian guys, are playing like it's baccarat. Like, I remember one of the first hands I played, a guy raises, and I had two queens, and I three bet him, and he said, okay, let's go, and he just put his chips in. I said, okay, and he had ace seven. And these guys are playing, you know, like in baccarat, you put your bet down. The way they were thinking of poker is, I'd never seen it thought about that way, but just, we'll take a shot, we'll shoot the money and let's go. And then I realized that the 5%, there was no rake when there wasn't a flop, which was nice, and also was capped. So people would have money beyond the cap, and then I quickly thought, oh, this is, it sounded really bad at 5%, but it wasn't this bad. But what happened was people like Joanda and Johnny Chan were there ahead of me. They had been there now for a year, and in the time that I was, you know, if I tried it out the year before, it would have been totally different. What happened is all these guys got money built up from these baccarat players playing poker. And the second year I was there, they had some game where it was a couple hundred thousand U.S. buy-in. But and it's money that they had, you know, won already, you know, just playing over the course of the year since I'd been there. And the games just kept getting bigger and bigger. And then they started getting exclusionary, too. If you didn't speak Cantonese, it was really hard to get in the game, and which was really frustrating for me because, believe it or not, when I was 17 or 18, I live with a bunch of guys from Hong Kong, and that's what we spoke was Cantonese. So I don't remember much Cantonese. I remember how to swear and stuff like that. But I did have, you know, about a year and a half where I spoke a lot of Cantonese when I was younger. I mean, it's 40 years ago, but, you know, I obviously have a head start in relearning it. So if I was, well, I still have, you know, I don't know how much time I spent there because my kids were still, you know, around 20. My youngest were, you know, we're that kind of age, and so I still don't like leaving, but certainly if I didn't have stuff over here to do, I was just camped out in
take Cantonese lessons.
Macau and, you know, and go on with the games. They build up. But what happens in situations like where people have lots of money, the good players keep winning money, and the really rich people, which is the way, you know, people know economies. I mean, we even have it in our country, but it's worse than others, where you have no middle class. You have very, very wealthy people and very poor people, and the wealthy people just get a piece of everything, you know, and they end up being billionaires. And that's how they have it there. So these people could play for enormous stakes. The poker players keep making more and more money. The stakes keep climbing. But you can't just get in there just cold turkey in those high stakes. You get there by building up. You know, there are a couple people who maybe got, you know, conglomerates where they, a lot of people go in to put someone in. But for the most part, people got there starting at a certain level and then playing higher and higher and higher. So it just got out of hand where, you know, there was no way I could have gotten in there financially. The games got so big. And there's no way they would have let me in anyway because, you know, you had to get welcomed in. You had to have people speak for you. And even a guy like Phil Ivey, you know, had trouble getting in the games. He had the money to play, but, you know, people wouldn't necessarily just let him play.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a tough thing. So the answer to your questions is, you know, I kind of missed the boat on that.
Danny Robeson, he died earlier this year. 2 months ago, you spoke at the Commerce Casino in Greater Los Angeles about Danny. He was known for some shenanigans. Near the end of his life, he found religion. Do you have any good Danny stories you can tell, remembering this is AM radio?
Yeah. I told a couple of risque stories. It's on, you know, I'm sure if you look on YouTube for the memorial in my name and Danny's name, his last name is actually Robinson, so it's like Robinson, but no N. So I did, in front of his wife and daughter, told the story where I just said, please don't listen to this. But they've heard it all. You know, once Danny got religion, he told all the lousy things he did. You know, and he did, you know, the way Vegas was, all these guys were on drugs. You know, as a lot of people know, he was partnered with Chip, and they did a lot of crazy things.
Chip Reese.
Yeah, Chip Reese. And I'm trying to think of stories that...
Well, Danny was known for betting and betting and betting and then chopping the pot. Where...
Yeah, and again, I don't know how high percent your audience are poker players, but yeah, he would get in there and find ways to get people to chop the pot, you know, when he couldn't beat their board. And then they made a rule for tourists probably about 15 years ago where it was just assumed if somebody called in seven card stud and couldn't beat the board, it was a mistake. The guy misread his hand, and you wouldn't want, if the guy couldn't beat the board, you'd always give him his last bet back. But Danny saw this as a perfect angle. He would call all the time when he couldn't beat the guy's board and then ask for a chop. And if the guy only had, let's say, a pair on board and was trying to act like he had two pair of bluff, of course he'd always give Danny half the pot. So it was a total free shot for Danny to call if he couldn't beat the guy's board. And then they had to make the Danny Robinson exception to that rule, which was Danny doesn't get to call when he can't beat the board and get half the pot.
Uh-huh. Very good. When he spoke about some of the cheating that went on by some very famous big names back a couple decades ago, did this surprise you? That how many?
No, as a matter of fact, a lot of people know, and it's written in my book. The reason I ended up being a surprise to people like Chip and Doyle, and you know, again, not to brag about it, but when I started playing with Chip and Doyle, I was better. You know, I was ended up being the best player in the game and the biggest winner. And they were saying, "How could this be?" They kept saying, "How could this be possible? That someone come out of nowhere and be the biggest winner in our game?" Well, the way it happened was in the 70s when I went to Vegas, there was a lot of cheating going on, and the house was in on it. I played at the Stardust, and they'd bring in cold decks, and they'd have teams, all this stuff. And I was already a professional poker player then. And I just said, I don't need this anymore. I don't need to play poker in Vegas. These guys are all cheaters. You know, I can go back to Illinois, you know, where I played for a living, and play in honest games. So if I ever went to Vegas, it was to play blackjack. I never played poker. So, of course, I knew about how the cheating was going on. I saw it firsthand. So it didn't surprise me at all. And I told myself I was never going to play poker in Vegas again, and that was in the 70s. And it wasn't until the 90s where the World Series started getting bigger where I decided to take a shot and go out again around 1991 because I heard the cash games were good at the World Series. So I did go out, and now poker had gotten bigger and it was different and, you know, didn't look as dishonest. There was still stuff going on even then, but it was, at least it had gotten cleaner. And so, no, none of it was a surprise. I knew it myself. I mean, the things that Danny saw were totally different. It was just everything was a hustle. It was, instead of gambling, it was really hustling. If you had a golf bet, then what would go on is somebody, you would have to guard your clubs. Because, like, I remember Billy Baxter left his clubs at the clubhouse. And so what happened is the obvious. Someone went in and took the weights out of his woods, you know, took the weights out. He goes the next day to hit his clubs, the weights are taken out, you know, which means they're off balance and you can't hit them. So all sorts of funny things. I mean, that's just what people would do. If they played gin rummy, there'd be a wire. The Dunes, which had the big game, I almost stepped into that accidentally. It had, like, the biggest game in town. You know, when I left the Stardust ever hit, and I went over to the Dunes, I heard those were the top players. I wasn't afraid to play it. And I remember I almost sat down and I said, I forget it. What's the point? I'd rather go back home. And, of course, I later found out they had a peephole where they would look at people's cards. And that was just the way things were done there. It was like, and you say, boy, they're a bunch of cheaters. But it was more like, in any game, that's what the rules, you know, you learn what the rules are. Everybody knew what the rules were. The rules were you
except
could do whatever
tourists.
You want, and if you got away with it, then, you know, that's life. I mean, I remember one time where Doyle made Chip and, you know, got beat out of money from Chip and Danny at Gin Rummy. He made them take their clothes off before he paid to prove they didn't have some sort of wire or device on them.
How clean is it now?
Well, in all fairness to Doyle, he and Eric Drake in 1978 opened up a card room at the Silverbird intentionally to have the first high-stakes games without cheating. Up until then, they were cheating, and anything high-stakes, there'd be something going on. And Doyle, who was obviously, you know, we see now how good a player he is even at 80 years old, was at this time becoming the best player in the world. And so obviously he felt it was in his best advantage if he could just get honest poker games. So that's why they opened this up, and they opened up this place where it started, you know, poker started to actually have an honest game. And they knew who all the main cheats and the guys with daub for the cards were, and they either froze them out or told them, you can play here, or you can't cheat. A lot of times these cheaters, the other people would want them in because they were bad players if they weren't cheating. You know, they had never learned how to play poker. They just learned to win by cheating. So it's funny, you know, at first they thought, hey, we'll bar the cheaters. But then the other player said, no, we want that guy in there. As long as you can stop him from cheating, we need him in the game. But anyway, so now it's pretty, I think it's pretty good. You know, there's surveillance. The only thing negative I can say about casinos is most of the surveillance and most of the things they look for are to protect themselves. If they have cameras, you think, oh, good, you know, they're protecting me against partners and all this kind of stuff. But really, they're looking to see that the dealer drops the time and nobody takes it. They're looking to protect themselves always more than you. The one place I think that protects you better, you know, obviously I'm a representative of Poker Stars, but I knew what they do with Poker Stars. They have like 400 full-time security people there. And the nice thing about it being online is if there's, you know, someone thinks there's something, first of all, the games are being monitored, and then someone will say, hey, you know, funny stuff happened. Can you look over the hands? And you can talk to anyone who's played for any amount of time, especially at the smaller stakes games on Poker Stars, and they'll get money put back in their account where they'll say, we looked over some hands. It was really funny the way these two guys were playing, and they always sit down together, whatever. It's being monitored. You know, you can monitor these things online a lot better than you can live. And you know, some people will say, you know, a bunch of scummy poker players cheating. Well, you know, anytime there's any money, whether it's business or anything else, there's always going to be some people trying to rob the bank, trying to do something, right? You know, it's just the way people are, or some people are. But I think overall poker is probably cleaner than business in most things. Especially if you have someone monitoring the game, you know, I certainly feel it's pretty safe on Poker Stars.
Now, do you spend a certain amount of time out of the country so that you can actually play on Poker Stars?
Well, the funny thing about that is I wanted to once the UIGA came down, and they didn't want me to because I'm American representative of Poker Stars. When I asked to, they said,
we don't want the DOJ looking like we're doing a workaround, because you're obviously American. You have three kids going to college in California. If we let you play while all this indictment, all this stuff's going on, it's going to look pretty funny. So they told me no. They said if I was a single guy, that, you know, where I didn't have necessarily have to stay in a certain place, then they could, you know, see that someone relocates for their job, right? That's a normal thing to do. So it ended up there were only two people they told could not relocate. See if you can guess the other one, who they felt represented a U.S. poker.
Chris Moneymaker.
That was the other one, exactly. Because they felt both of those would look really funny.
Sure.
I wasn't allowed. And then the last couple of years, I kept thinking I am going to get to play in the United States. I thought PokerStars was going to open up in New Jersey. And I would have moved out there. And now I thought by the end of the year, PokerStars might open up here in California. But now it's looking a little questionable if we'll get in that soon.
Well, they've actually been sold in the past couple months. How does that affect you, or does it?
Well, there's good news and there's bad news for me. The bad news. The bad news is I've actually had a lot of influence in PokerStars with upper management and the guys who are going to be stepping down, and dealt with them personally. So that's bad. I don't know the people in Amaya. You know, hopefully I'll develop a relationship there. But I was involved in a lot of decisions with PokerStars the way it is. I was the one who started putting the mixed games. I was involved in putting non-hold'em games on the client, getting the 8-game and all that stuff, getting triple draw. I was the one who spec'd that stuff out. So I had a lot of influence that, you know, I potentially can lose. The good thing is, you know, we're thinking that now that Amaya has bought PokerStars, a lot of people are trying to freeze us out of the U.S. market and saying it's because there's an indictment going on. That's kind of a bogus thing, but that was the excuse that was being used. So I'm hoping now that Amaya will be taking over, that we'll be able to get into the U.S. market, but that hasn't happened yet. So, you know, that could be a potentially good thing. So we'll see. So I guess the answer is I don't know yet.
All right. We're going to take a brief commercial break, and then we have some more questions for you. Hopefully you can stay on for a few minutes.
Sure.
Thank you. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else has. July is half-price gas card month, normally for 8,333 points. You can get $25 in cash or free play. Now, for points earned and redeemed in July, you can get a $50 Chevron gas card for the same number of points, maximum 10 cards per person. This is a type of double points up to your first $83,000 coin in. There'll be video poker classes starting there in September on Wednesdays. We'll talk more about that as we get closer. At the Palms, 7 p.m. drawings in June. You need to swipe your card before 6:45 p.m. Drawing takes place at 7. They post the winners, and you have until midnight to claim. If you do not claim by midnight, the prize money evaporates. Double entries on Sundays and Tuesdays all day. 5 times entries Friday night and Saturday night, 8 p.m. to midnight. PFP, play for points, Monday through Friday for the rest of the month, which is going to end August 1st, insofar as the promotion goes. You get gift cards to TJ Maxx or Marshalls. The rate for earning the cards is 0.25% for video poker players, 2% for slot players. You keep the points. There was a time where we announced that we're going to have free video poker classes at the Palms in August. That will not be happening. Management had a change of heart on this. I apologize for any inconvenience it causes you. Trust me, it causes me inconvenience as well. At videopoker.com, it remains the best place to practice a wide variety of games, including Quick Quads, Ultimate X, Extra Draw Frenzy Poker, Hyper Bonus, and many others. often. These are the best returning games in a casino, and you can practice them online for free. They have weekly contests. The weekly contest this month is 100 play. 100 play is played exactly the same as a single line game, only for smaller stakes. It lowers the volatility considerably for both the house and the player if you can find the same pay schedule. At the same time, it puts a premium on dealt hands. On a single line game, a dealt royal and a royal that you have to raise from a pup earn the same 4,000 coins. In 100 play, a dealt royal is worth quite a bit because you get the royal on all 100 lines. So it's a lot of fun, and I enjoy that game a lot. On next week's show, we're going to have a repeat visit from Mo Savastava, who was teaching us how to beat lotteries when he was here recently. He'll be back next week. All right, Barry, back to you. There, a year and a half ago, you were inducted into the Poker Hall of Fame. They're having a new Hall of Fame vote very soon. As one of the relatively few living Hall of Fame members, you get a major vote as to who makes it. How do you like this process of you getting to vote on the Hall of Fame members?
Well, I remember discussing with Chip, I kind of assumed I would get in the Hall of Fame because the criteria were that you had to be a high-stakes player, and there aren't that many. And then we started seeing tournament players get in. If you're a high-stakes poker player, you can, certainly in the past, maybe not so much now, you kind of look down on the tournament players when the tournaments weren't as big because they weren't the same level of player. So, you know, we had at the high-stakes game, we only had a pool of 10 to 15 players, so you kind of assume just about all of them are going to get in, that, you know, if they induct one or two people every year. But I had told Chip at the time that once they started letting people in who I didn't think really deserved to be in there, you know, with, I don't want to name names, people who've never played poker bigger than, 30, 60 poker, you know, poker for $1,000 instead of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I said, you know, it just didn't seem right to me. And I remember I told Chip, I said, I'll be the first one to turn it down. And I said, I would never accept being into the Hall of Fame until they change the system and make it be by vote. And then, and I think I even mentioned this to Jeffrey, I've already forgot Jeffrey's last name, Jeffrey Pollock, but, you know, and he was the one who came, you know, who then went through where he had media people vote on it and Hall of Fame members vote on it, kind of like they do in sports. But if I'd have been picked, I'd have turned it down. But once it was put to a vote, now it's a more reasonable system. So that was the good thing. The bad thing was the people don't get in based on the real criteria. For instance, last year, if you go by the criteria that there are, which is having to play at the highest stakes games, the only one who really qualified probably was Jennifer Harmon, you know, who's played in a lot of the high stakes games. But now people are inducted based on their tournament resumes. And, you know, for the last several years, we get a lot of people who have a good tournament record rather than by beating, you know, the best players in the world in the highest stakes games. So they probably need to rewrite the criteria so it doesn't look like a farce, because you read the criteria and then you look at the player who's got inducted, you say, well, that guy never played high stakes. But he did win a big tournament. But anyway, it's I think it's okay now, if they just follow what I said and rewrite the criteria so it matches who gets put in. It's okay. You know, the only downside is, the reason, you know, people are going, hey, you know, Tom's pretty ungrateful. You got inducted to the Hall of Fame. You should be really happy about it. Poker is different than sports in that a lot of the accomplishments that the public sees are by someone having a great tournament record. You know, like even with me, you introduced me to someone who won some World Series events and won some World Poker Tour events. And, you know, the correlating factor to winning those is because I played a lot of events. There are a lot of great poker players who just play cash games and have won a lot of money, but no one's ever going to think of them as getting into the Hall of Fame, even if they're better than some of these Hall of Fame players, because they're either at home at their home casinos or wherever. But like I said, there are players all around the country and all around the world who are really great players who have no shot. So you don't have that in sports where the best basketball player in the world wouldn't get inducted because he's playing some other form of basketball. He would get noticed. You know what I'm saying? So it's a little different. And so poker accolades are mostly connected to how many races you enter. You know, it's not a batting average. You just enter a lot of races, you're going to hit sometimes, and then people are going to think you're a good player.
Oh, that must be why we think Phil Ivey's a good player.
No, but he's got a good percentage. You know, there are other people who, if you look at how many events they played, or, you know, people have gone, you know, there are some people who've played for years lots and lots of tournaments. And so, of course, they have, you know, but, you know, obviously you're being facetious. But the difference is Phil Ivey, not only has he won those bracelets, which, of course, if he came on your show, you'd be talking about the bracelets, but he played in the highest stakes cash games and won there, and he played online, and he won more money than anyone else there. So that's the whole point I'm getting at, is he does obviously meet whatever criteria you're going to put up there.
He may not be old enough. But he may not be old enough at this point.
Right, and if 40 years old, he will obviously be inducted as soon as he turns 40.
As he should be. I was being facetious.
No, I know that, but I'm saying there will be other people, and again, I'm not picking names, where you look, and you may have heard of them because they won some World Series bracelets or World Poker or whatever, but they aren't beating the best players in the world. They're not, you know, in a lot of cases, they're not even winning players.
All right. We have about 2 minutes left. You're known as the Robin Hood of poker. You've given away maybe half of your $8 million in tournament winnings to charity. It's pretty rare in the poker world. Poker world's largely me first. Why do you do this?
Well, first of all, see, that's another misnomer. You said $8 million in winnings. That's $8 million in cashing out. How much you spend? I think I've spent on tournament entries. I've probably given out all my winnings. You know what I'm saying? Because I had to pay tournament entries. The reason I did it at the time, I was a cash game player and I was doing well financially, and I just thought it was the right thing to do. I think there's a natural connection of gambling, I'll say gambling in general because you're a gambling show, but certainly poker players, the people helping out, being generous. I think they're a lot more generous than the general public. And, you know, some people listening who aren't gamblers might say, well, that doesn't make sense to me. They're all chasing money. I would think they are guarding their money more than the average person. But really, the reason that gamblers are able to bet these sums and do all this stuff is because they don't care about money as much. Even if they chase it, they're still willing to bet it on a bluff, bet it on a football game, bet it on any of these things that you're talking about on your show, where the general public is, I remember seeing Bill Gates playing $3, $6 at the Bellagio, and then someone said, hey, there's a 4-800 game over there. Why don't you play that? And he said, are you kidding? I'm not going to play that big. You know, the general public, they don't want to lose that kind of money, that hard-earned money. Whereas a gambler doesn't care about money the same way, so he's willing to do something positive. And for me, who's gambled for a living his whole life, be able to take, you know, I always said if I ever made a lot of money, when I saw, you know, people playing bigger than me, there would be $100,000 in a pot or something like that, I said, just think what you could do with that money, the positive things you could do, if you could just kind of sneak it off the table. And seeing that so many gamblers just, you know, as we say, anecdotally spend it on hookers and blow, I said, wouldn't it be nice to actually spend it on...
Thank you very much, Barry Greenstein. Thank you, Richard Munchkin. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.